Shenanigans, folks, to All Things Trek here on allthingstrek.com.
Yeah.
That was not live, a broadcast. It is 4 o'clock where we are, 7 o'clock Eastern right now, where someone else is on the East Coast, but it probably won't be when you're listening to this.
Yeah, you know, I almost, out of habit, I almost said when you paused, I almost said Rise of Radio, and I was like, no more.
It is a terrible force of habit, isn't it?
It is, and we've been done with that for an entire episode already.
Whole episode.
Man, can you believe, this is episode 10, this is like a milestone for us.
Well,
and so, like, to celebrate that, as a guest today, we have a very good friend of mine, Grace Moore.
Hi.
Hi, Grace.
Sup?
And so we brought Grace on the show because she, unlike Bob and I, was not raised on Star Trek.
But boo!
Oh, quiet, Bob. Quiet, oh. Quiet you.
Quiet me.
But the point of this is that I'd say that the majority of the people listening to this right now have probably been Star Trek fans for a while. They were either raised on Star Trek or they watched Star Trek as a kid. And because, you know, other than the Abrams movie, there hasn't been a lot of Star Trek recently. And the stuff there was before that, no two ends about it, was really bad.
But we might be getting some more Star Trek soon at some point in the near future.
Fingers crossed.
Yes, we did. A guy named David Foster, I think.
He actually got his name?
Yeah, David Foster is his name. He's in charge of 1947 Entertainment Productions, which I desperately tried to find some kind of record on, and I can't. Outside of their company webpage, I wasn't able to find, like, a Wikipedia entry, even. Grace, do you know anything about them?
Can't say I do.
Yeah.
Well, dang.
All I know is that their company webpage claims that they've had, like, that some of their members have had, like, experience working on Star Trek and Star Wars and the Twilight series, of all things.
Did elaborate on what kind of experience?
Special effects experience.
Ooh.
That's pretty cool.
And, like...
Yeah, but I can flash a light. I mean, I can do that. I mean...
Yeah, but can you do it with, like, union approval?
I could probably get it.
Get some union approval. Man, union approval is harder to get than you might think.
Well...
I had to work for a long time to get, like, stagehand union approval.
I don't need anyone's approval.
I don't want your approval. You show them. You be a strong liberated person.
Word.
Now, anyway...
The union will have something to say about them. They'll send the mafia over to break their legs.
Now, the thing about...
Is it the mafia or the mob? It's the mafia, isn't it?
I don't really think there's a reasonable difference for these purposes. but what the thing that like, weirded me out a little bit about the proposed new show, is that they really didn't say a whole lot about it. Like, there was a lot of words in the article, but they didn't really actually describe the show, because they clearly haven't been told a whole lot. But the thing that I don't understand about it is, like, there are two points that kind of weirded me out. The first was an indication that they were going to go with a very young crew in the style of the J.J. Abrams movie, and it's like, you know, that, typically speaking, the crew of a starship is not going to be very young. Like, the J.J. Abrams movie got away with it because no one was actually watching that movie for its plot.
Yeah, true.
I mean, seriously, was anyone watching that movie for its plot? I mean, I liked that movie, and its plot was asinine, and I just ignored it.
I mean, as soon as I realized, like, what the explanation was for, like, the alternate reality nonsense, that's when I stopped paying attention and looked at the pretty lights that, J.J. Abrams' company was, like, delivering me, because it's not ILM anymore that's doing that. It's some other company right now.
Yes, just watch the movie. Let the lens flare take you away.
Yeah, my goodness, I walked into the Apple store the moment I saw that bridge. But, you know, it's just, as soon as that hit and the explanation started to go up, it's like, I saw the attempt to try to give me something for my brain to nom on, but it's just like, no, you're just not doing it.
There's no brain food here.
There isn't.
And then the other thing I just don't understand why they would want to go with a really young crew, because this is a television show. This is going to need a plot to tie
together. Sex appeal.
Oh, is that what we're doing? Because that worked out really well for Enterprise. Sex appeal.
they only had one bit of sex appeal, and that was, at least for the guys, Julian Blalock, right?
I don't know. When I think sexy, I think Quantum Leap.
Scott Bakula is your...
Oh, good.
Is Scott Bakula your cup of tea, Grace?
Ah.
Is Scott Bakula really your cup of tea?
Just for the look on Oren's face today, it is.
All right, well, I'll let that slide for now.
You want to hurt me so much. But that is, and that aside, there was also this weird little line where it mentioned that the Klingons were restless after the Praxis incident, like, forgetting, and they didn't want to rely on the Federation for help anymore. And I'm going to assume that was a goof, because, like, you know, canon speaking, the Praxis incident is, like, a century ago? Like, way back in Star
Trek
6.
You're talking 2288, I want to say?
Something like that. It took a while to react,
didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, we already resolved all that. I watched Star Trek 6. I saw them resolve that. You can't bring that up now and say it's a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, it would make sense if they just replaced Praxis with Dominion War, because they did drop some lines in DS9 about how the... about how the Klingon economy was going to be wrecked after the war, and I could see the Federation having to give them, like, you know, some aid to get their systems back on its feet.
Yep, that would be cool.
Speaking of DS9, Grace, is it true that you recently finished watching the Deep Space Nine series?
No, but I've watched the majority of it.
So you haven't watched the end?
No.
Ooh.
How far are you so far? How far are you so far? Gosh, I'm redundant.
It's redundant and repetitive. I think I'm going through season 5 right now.
Ooh.
Okay, we're going to have to be careful what we say here. We haven't
I've already had a bunch spoiled for me by you guys, so. Okay,
so I guess I can talk about
that. That's amazing, since this is the first time I've talked to you.
Well, not you specifically. I'm speaking, like, about you nerd people.
It's okay. Nerd well, when you leave, you can take home, I have the, you can take home season 6 and 7.
Yay!
So I can talk, you already know about Ezri. I don't have to watch my mouth, I don't have to watch my mouth about that.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So, like, and you, and so, just for the record.
The new Dax, right?
Yeah, the new Dax. Yeah, so for the record, like, when, you were pretty much introduced to Star Wars when.
Trek.
Yeah, to just, did I say Star Wars?
Yes. You did say Star Wars.
Oh my goodness.
Wrong podcast.
I mean,
all right. If, were I,
wow, Warren.
Were
wow.
I a man of lesser integrity, I would edit that out of the podcast, but you guys are going to hear it, so I didn't. All right, so you were first introduced to Star Trek when myself and my girlfriend showed you Deep Space Nine?
Just about. I'd seen a few episodes of Next Generation beforehand. Mm-hmm. Like, I saw them after school when they were, like, showing on UPN after... I think that must have been when I was in late middle school, early high school, but yeah, that was about it.
So what was your first impression? You saw the opening gambit, you saw the credits go there, you watched the episode and the credits rolled. What was your first impression?
My first impression. Wow, that's a lot of space.
That's a lot of space.
It is a lot of space. When I first watched DS9, I know I was a little transfixed on that comet. I was like, what's going on with this comet? Is this comet going to be a plot device? This comet is here. This credit sequence is making a big deal about this comet.
You thought way harder about the initial, like,
weirdly
5 minutes of the show that I did.
Weirdly enough is, every time I, like, saw the opening credits, I'd think, okay, this, there's intense music here. This sounds really important. Should I be paying attention right now? So for the first couple of episodes, I always read entirely through the opening credits, because I was like, okay, it feels like there should be something important here.
Well, yeah, the actors' names.
All right, so
and other people who were involved with the show. This is important. Don't don't you belittle their station and position.
I'm not
belittling. All right, so Avery Brooks is still starring in this show. That's good to know. It would be weird if he was just suddenly not there. That would be an indication something was up.
Well, like I said, my only real experience with Star Trek before this was some Next Generation stuff, and I was used to... seeing that, wait, the blonde chick, what happened to the blonde chick?
Denise Crosby, she's talking about Tasha Yar.
Yeah, Tasha Yar.
Yeah.
That was, I had that reaction when I first watched TNG, because I didn't see the episode where Tasha died.
I didn't watch them in order at all.
I just saw a few episodes that had her in it, and then she wasn't there anymore, and I was like, And then I asked my parents, and I think for my parents, telling me that Tasha Yar was dead was like telling me that Santa wasn't real. Like, they didn't want to. I mean, you know, my mom was on the show earlier. She
you got way more wrapped up in Tasha Yar than I ever did.
Well, I mean, you know.
You might want to skip watching Pet Sematary. Just saying.
Oh, dear. So, and since
why do you tell them things like that? No.
And since then, you've seen, like, some TOS, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Right, I watched some TOS mixed with some... Next Gen.
So you started with Next Generation DS9 first, then, before you watched TOS.
Yes, pretty
much. Oh man, please tell me what you think of the two.
Well, like I
said... Or three.
Well, like I said, my first real introduction to anything Star Trek related was back in middle school, early high school, and a few back in grade school when I'd be babysat by my dad's friends who would just have it on in the background. And as a child, I didn't gather much from it, but I gathered that I wanted to grow up and marry LeVar Burton so we could have reading adventures in space.
That's a fair lesson to draw from Next Generation, I'd say.
Yeah.
But
that and me and
I
my
think
sister.
It's the first time I ever heard LeVar Burton referred to like that way before as the man I want to marry and have like space reading adventures with.
I was 7.
That's
See, this is why it's
intriguing. I've just never heard those words come out of anyone's mouth before like that.
Well, you know, I think that the two of us, being of the guy persuasion and all, probably aren't going to look at the show exactly.
Hey, LeVar Burton is a sexy guy. I'm not saying he's not. I'm just, wow, space reading adventures.
Well, I mean,
that's the part that kind of got me more than the marrying him. Like, I understand why someone wants to marry LeVar Burton or Jordy LaForge or whoever you want to look him as. just reading Adventures in Space?
Well, I'll tell you what.
He's an engineer.
I was confused the first time I saw Reading Rainbow, because I saw LeVar Burton, and I thought I was going
to watch. Why is the chief engineer of the Enterprise teaching me how to read?
Well, no, I didn't even understand.
Where's your visor?
I didn't even understand what it was at the time. I thought it was just going to... I thought, like, you know, the next generation was about to start. But, so now that you've...
On PBS.
So now that you have seen some episodes of TOS after seeing, like, TNG and Deep Space Nine, how do they make you feel? How do they compare, do you think?
Do you thought it was better, it was worse?
I think they both have their high points in very different ways. Chronologically, I was introduced to Next Generation, like I said, and then Deep Space Nine, and then the original series. But Star Trek, the original series, has such a cultural basis to it these days. It has become so ingrained in the world of pop culture and just of common media knowledge that I had a few pretty strong ideas of what it was all about before I even watched it.
I sneezed, by the way.
Bless you.
That's a cool little spike there on the on the audio recorder.
I have made my stamp on the digital verse.
So, yeah. And as someone who grew up watching a lot of cable access TV and a lot of... a lot of cable access TV and bad horror movies, I was actually pretty used to sort of the oeuvre of Star Trek before I saw it, so...
You mean like the cardboard sets and the cheesy special effects?
Yeah, the old Roger Corman horror films and stuff, the hammy acting. I was pretty used to that already, which actually made it a pretty easy integration when I did start getting into Star Trek, because I already had developed a pretty good sense of suspension of disbelief.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah.
What would you say your favorite Trek episode is?
Ooh.
That you've seen so far, obviously.
I'm going to have to think about that.
Well, you have plenty of time, I assure you.
Do I have to pick from a specific series?
No.
No, but if you want to, you can limit it to DS9, since that's the one you've seen the most of.
No, give her all options all times.
I'm going to have to think about that one a little bit.
Okay. That's cool.
Can you come back to me?
Well, we can come back on that.
Okay.
Did you ever see the Ferengi in The Next Generation?
Yeah, I did.
What did you think of how they, like, how they changed from TNG to Deep Space Nine?
Well, they definitely changed for the better, for one thing.
That's true.
They just felt,
I want a Marauder Moe action figure.
Oh my goodness.
Don't we all?
That was an obscure reference right there.
But I got it, though, right?
What audience do we have, Orin? What audience do we have?
I almost didn't get it. I was searching my brain. I was like, what is that a reference to? I was like, oh, right, Quark. Okay, cool.
I got to admit, I'm a sucker for the Moogie episodes. I just think she's adorable.
Ishka is a really interesting character right up until the last couple episodes.
That's what I hear, yeah.
Yeah. The long story short is that they pull a ridiculous character assassination on her and I feel like Quark's, like, last scene where he's, like, raging about the transformation of Ferengi society just makes me feel like the writers never took the Ferengi seriously, which is sad.
It doesn't feel like that when they first show up in TNG either. It feels like they've been built up to be something serious, but when they actually show up, you're just kind of like, really? This is the threat here?
We had the
Klingons in the original series, and now we've got these guys?
But energy whips.
Energy whips.
Without energy, like, you know, the Klingons. The Klingons didn't have energy whips. Yeah, I think it was. I think they definitely made the right choice switching to the Borg as the Federation's primary threat.
Most definitely, the Ferengi looked like someone you could take down with just a slight push of your hand.
But you couldn't. They were stronger than they appeared.
Actually, they weren't. So you remember, I mean, like
that's what Data said. Remember, it was
he said the
Last Outpost, season one, episode 5.
Right. He says that, but like in the first episode where they encounter the Ferengi, doesn't Riker like wrestle like three of them? They're like
no,
all climbing
no,
on him.
No, it was the landing party, which is Data, Worf, Geordi, and Riker.
It? Yeah.
All hanging out on the planet surface. It was the last outpost.
Yar.
This is the
Kashyar was also there.
Yar was there, but she wasn't actually in the fight because she came later with a phaser.
Yeah.
And they were wrestling him, and it was actually a bit of an even fight. Is what it was. I mean, Data was the only one who actually truly had one man handled by holding him up in the air.
Right. We have to watch this episode.
And Riker was like, "I got this one," and Data's like, "No, no, you don't." And sure enough, it goes down.
That's not how I remember it. We have to watch this episode again. Do you have a favorite character?
From any particular series?
Sure, any series.
I gotta say I've got a soft spot for Data, just because I think he's an interesting character. And
good choice.
And I just really like the amount of versatility that Brett Spiner is able to show with the different characters who are all pretty much based off of this singular character.
Yeah, I really like.
And I think that he really got a good chance to showcase a bunch of his skills through that.
Yeah, and some of the later episodes, especially with Data and Lore.
Yeah.
Or like the one with, I forget what it's called, but it's the one with Data, Lore, and Sung in it. So it's Brent Spiner talking to Brent Spiner about Brent Spiner.
Yeah. Brothers.
Brothers? That
Brothers.
One. That's a really good episode.
Season 4, episode 3.
Although that is one of the episodes where like Data like somehow defeats the entire ship. Like Data rebels and they just can't stop him. And it's like, alright, that's kind of a weird precedent to set, but...
Well, he was able to, like, manipulate his voice to sound like other people's voices, so, I mean, he sounded like Picard, that's how he did that.
Yeah.
There's a recorder somewhere on the whole...
I'm just a little bothered by the idea that, like, one member of the crew can defect, and, like, there's nothing the rest of the ship can do to stop him.
Well, there probably aren't that many Starfleet officers who have the capability of just replicating the captain's voice at will.
Well, I mean, yeah,
except for that one guy who does ventriloquism.
Yeah, I mean, like,
you mean voice imitation? Ventriloquism.
Well, I mean, like, Crusher did, like, Wesley does it in that one episode. I mean, voice imitation.
He set up some force fields and ran around at Jeffrey's tubes.
No, he took over the ship. Remember, he was running engineering because he had all the passcodes and he had like he like imitated the captain's voice. Granted, this was season one where they did a lot of stupid stuff, but.
Weirdly enough.
Oh, I was thinking of the game. I'm sorry. Weirdly, well, yeah, but, I mean, the entire crew was, like, you know, had the sex sickness, whatever it was, going on.
Well, in the...
Well, really sex sickness. That was Hosh's thing, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean...
So you're all drunk. No.
In the game, I actually thought it was a fairly good... I thought the game was a fairly good example of one crew member who has a very intimate knowledge of the ship's systems, like, trying to evade the rest. He's able to evade them for a little while, because he knows a lot about the ship, and he's able to set up, you know, his site-to-site transporters and what have you, but he can't, like, infinitely escape them.
Infinite escape.
He eventually gets caught, although that episode was stupid for another reason, which was that for some reason they didn't just put on the devices and pretend they were brainwashed. I don't really know why they didn't do that.
Well, they did it first.
They did it once, and it worked, and then they stopped doing it, and it was like, why did you stop, guys? Alright, so...
What was the question we originally asked you, Grace?
We originally asked what her favorite episode
about
was.
Yes, okay.
And she hasn't quite figured out what her favorite episode is yet.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to weigh my favorites from the different series.
Well, if you had several to choose from, then what would they be?
From the original series, I know this probably isn't a strongly supported choice, but I'd have to say What Little Girls Are Made Of, because I liked the fact that they got to sort of show a little more of Chapel in that episode. I think she's a fun character who really got underused.
I don't remember this episode.
Yeah, well, is that one of the ones with Harvey Mudd?
No.
Okay, what happens in that episode? I know the name. The name is familiar.
It's the one where they track down Chapel's fiance and find out he's been building robots.
Oh, right, that one.
Oh my god, that's where Kirk's holding the penis rock.
Yep,
yes.
That's the penis
so
rock.
Many memes, so many memes have come from that. Can't believe I didn't remember that.
And weirdly enough, it's also got the guy who played Lurch in the original version of The Addams Family on it.
I thought he was just playing Lurch in that episode.
Which is so funny because then the second guy who played Lurch was Luxuana Troy's personal assistant in Next Generation.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah.
Lurch was all over the Star Trek universe. Yeah, that's a decent episode, and I do agree that Nurse Chapel was underused, especially since this was Michelle Barrett, and we know what Michelle Barrett can do.
Majel Barrett?
Yeah, you're right. Majel Barrett. I apologize. Mm-hmm.
She seemed like a cool lady.
So that was TOS, TNG.
TNG. Once again, since I'm a sucker for Data, I'm going to probably say Data's Day, or one whose name is totally escaping me, where Pixar.
I'd love to see a Star Trek Pixar film.
We're all holding out for it.
I'd love to see that.
My mind is wandering a little. Where Picard's brain gets probed by the space probe, and he lives someone else's...
The Inner Light.
Yeah, that one.
That episode went on to win a number of awards.
I gotta say that one really touched
me. As well as having, I think, what was acclaimed to be the best musical composition, the Picard flute thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is one of the... That episode is really good for a number of reasons. And it is also, it's also one of the only episodes in TNG that spawns direct continuity, because after that episode, Picard can play the flute.
This is true.
And it's like, huh, this made a lasting impression. It's also, I think, one of the only Star Trek... I think there are two Star Trek episodes after TOS that won Hugo Awards, and it's that one and All Good Things. Remind me, what was Data's Day? Like, what happened?
Data's Days are literally following Data around for the day.
On the day of Chief O'Brien and Keiko's wedding.
We actually just watched that earlier today.
We did watch that earlier today. I'm surprised you didn't catch it.
Yeah.
I thought it just had some very interesting character interactions for it.
See, that episode was dragged down for me by Keiko O'Brien. But I do understand why you liked it.
You need to start a new show. Everybody hates Keiko.
Man, that'd be a rad show.
I'm not joining you for that one, Oren.
No, I can do that for myself.
You're fine solo on that one.
Give Rosalind Cho her credit. She did do what she could.
Yeah, that wasn't the actress's fault, but Keiko is just a bad person, which is a spot for another time. I do apologize for just saying that and not giving context. Suffice it to say, that is my opinion. I don't like Keiko as a character. Eventually, we'll get to a DS9 episode, and I'll explain why.
Speaking of DS9, what's your favorite DS9 episode?
Oh, favorite DS9 episode. I should have thought about this already, shouldn't I?
Well,
you've seen up to season 5 so far, right?
Yeah, but there's still a lot to choose from.
A lot to choose from.
Since it's also recent to me, I'm trying to think. Can you, if you throw some episode titles at me, I can tell you my opinion.
Well, okay, so you've seen up to...
Oh, wow, my favorites are after season 5.
Yeah, that's true. So you haven't seen, like, In the Pale Moonlight, then?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
The Quickening was a good one.
Quickening is pretty good. The one with
That was pre-season 5.
Yeah, that was season 3, I think.
Which one was that again?
That was the one where they went to the where Bashir goes to the planet of people with the virus that they're born with, that was implied that the Dominion was responsible.
Right.
I did really like that episode.
I thought it was kind of interesting that they were able to sort of do that take on the whole...
Just so I can clarify, you've seen all the way to the end of season 4 or starting season 5? You've seen all of season 5?
All the way, like, halfway... almost done with season 5.
So you've seen Klingon War stuff happen already?
Yeah.
Okay. The one where it's Jake and Bashir going somewhere in the runabout?
Jake and Bashir go to Nam?
It's like the Vietnam thing? Yeah, exactly. That one, I like that one. As well.
I liked that way you summarized that Jake Sisko goes to Nam.
That's how we describe it. Which, I mean, that's kind of what it is. You know, it's like, guy gets thrown into this horrible kind of war atrocity type situation. Oh man, this is the kind of stuff that's happening. It's terrible stuff. You don't want to be here.
See, it's a good episode, although it's a little bit undermined by the scene where Jake is supposedly running through the artillery fire. And you see the Klingon mortars going off, and they're like... pop rocks, like they create like a little foot high puff of smoke, and one of them literally goes off like 6 inches away from Jake, and he's like not even like cut by it. It's like, so what are the Klingons bombarding us with exactly?
Baseballs from high orbit, maybe.
And this was a clear example of I assume that scene was filmed and scripted, and then they got to the special effects and didn't have the budget to do the effects they wanted.
Probably
because like if their special effects budget was that low, they would have been better off, I think, having some off-screen explosions and then throwing some rocks at him.
Well, if I could backtrack a minute a little bit farther back to the Quickening, I didn't get to really say anything on that. I would like to say is that I liked that episode seemed to kind of be a riff on sort of this Star Trek trope of Starfleet being able to just waltz in, fix problems, and leave. I liked how they were sort of able to show this fallibility to the resources of Starfleet, and also sort of the fallibility of Bashir.
But he fixed the problem.
Sort of.
But he totally did.
No, first he made it a lot...
The current generation wouldn't have, like, you know, the vaccine and stuff, and they'd die this horrible quickening death, but...
Well...
All the kids would be good.
But
what I'm saying still stands. It showed a level of fallibility there that I thought was very interesting, and also very humanizing for Bashir. Which is also kind of interesting when you look at it in a different light when you find out about the whole genetic modification thing later on.
Yeah. So
you cite these things from after season 5. It's just like, what can I not talk about?
What season am I on, even?
Are you sure you're not on season 6? Because the genetic engineering doesn't come up until then. I do definitely agree with you on Bashir on the Quickening, especially because you'll note that first, he actually makes things worse before he fixes them.
Yes, he does. Oh, my goodness.
And then, even though he has helped them, it's clear that he doesn't consider this a solution.
No.
Like, he's still trying to find a cure, because he knows that even though he may have saved the Next Generation, not the series, that was already done, but, you know, he may have saved the Next Generation, his people, he hasn't done anything for the ones who are alive now.
A lot of people
They're all
die.
Still going to die horribly.
Yeah.
And so I definitely agree with you there. You know, one thing, I would pay money to know if Bashir being genetically engineered was planned or if they decided on that later. Because there are sometimes...
That's a very good question.
Sometimes I think
it was Ronald Moore who was a part of a lot of that, wasn't it?
Yeah, Ron Moore was
part of it. As we know from the latest BSG, like, reimagining, you know, he just threw darts at a board to figure out who was a Cylon.
This is true. But Ira Stephen Bear was also a part of that. And he's...
Was it that guy in darts?
Ira Stephen Bear is pretty good about keeping continuity, so I would be interested... I just want to know. Like, I could see it being either way.
Uh-huh.
But, so, yeah, go ahead. I digress. If we could move on to the next episode we were talking about, the Adventures in Nom 1. I've got some sort of iffy personal connections to that idea. I actually have family members who went through a lot of shell shock in Nom, so I'm kind of disinclined to feel too much opinionated about that, personally. It feels like it'd be kind of taboo for me.
That's fair enough. I mean, do you feel it was a disrespectful episode, or
no? I just feel like it was all kind of shrugged aside very quickly. I would have liked to have seen that referenced further on, or for there to have been for it to have some kind of standing about that. It just it was an interesting idea. I just wasn't crazy about how it was carried out.
They do, I think, a better job in It's Only a Paper Moon, which I'm pretty sure you haven't seen yet. No. It's the one where Nog comes back after losing a leg.
Dang.
Yeah, they do a pretty good job with the post-traumatic stress after that, although that is another episode where they show that Starfleet counselors are really bad at their jobs.
I'm pretty convinced that it's just Ezri and Troy that are bad at their jobs.
So they aren't all busty telepaths?
No, this one's Ezri is actually a counselor, and she is a mousy trill, and she's also really bad at being a counselor, incidentally. Granted, maybe she was better before she got joined. I suppose that's possible. But something else I wanted to ask, have you seen much sci-fi outside of Star Trek?
I think so. I've got a pretty good exposure to it. Like I said, I've kind of got a love of the camp sci-fi genre. I watched a lot of Star Wars as a kid, I've watched through all of Firefly. I just generally like it as a genre. I'd say I've got a okay knowledge of it.
Have you seen Babylon 5 or Battlestar Galactica?
No, I have not.
All right. Well, how would you, like...
Only the stuff I've seen just hanging out on your couch.
That's fair. How would you, like...
Interesting way to sort through your own personal sci-fi library when it happens to be hanging out on his couch.
My couch is a rad source of sci-fi, I'll have you know.
It's true. It's a magical place.
All right. So how would you... How does, like, Star Trek, especially, like, Deep Space Nine, or even maybe other series, I guess I shouldn't have limited that to Deep Space Nine, but how does Star Trek, like, compare to the other sci-fi that you've seen?
Star Trek or Deep Space Nine specifically?
Either one.
Well, Deep Space Nine specifically, I'm actually going to say it's kind of along the lines of something that I think it was Bashir that said in the first episode of Deep Space Nine about it being like a really frontier scenario. And that was kind of what
this is where heroes are made.
But yeah, kind of. I liked that idea of trying to establish new ideas and new connections in a place where they've established that in continuity they've got hundreds and hundreds of years worth of so much knowledge of all these different races and different places, and the idea that there's always something new to explore and something new to learn. I just thought that was kind of an enticing idea from the beginning.
All right, now this one's a little bit deep. Based on what you saw from DS9, how would you describe the Federation as a society?
Federation as a society. That's a tough one.
It is a bit. That's why I asked it.
Yeah, I'm good. Fair enough. The Federation as a society... if I can reference back to what I said.
Yeah, please do.
Well, you do have experience with Star Trek Online, right?
Yes.
All right, and you have kind of some idea what the fluff is behind that?
Sort of, yeah.
Use that as a bit of an aid if you need to, because a lot of it ties in with Deep Space Nine as well.
This is true.
Well, for one thing, personally I see the Federation as being just a little invasive, for one thing.
No, it's really funny to me because he doesn't play Star Trek Online. You have no idea how true that statement is.
Well, I'm speaking as someone who's played Star Trek Online, and based on my knowledge of Star Trek in general, there's very much an attitude of going in, shuffling things around as you will, and then just going about your business. I mean, they go, they explore, they get what they need, and then they sort of try and repurpose things in ways that are convenient to Starfleet, which sounds a little politically... charged, if you think about current politics and
stuff. Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, so I had that kind of on the brain that might have affected that. But
no, I could totally see where you're going from with that.
But I do really like the idea of an integrated society like that is all about learning and exploring and all. But Also, you gotta remember, it is sort of a military organization, so
there are some who would disagree with that.
Really?
Yeah, that was actually the next question I wanted to ask, is how do you, like, there are some people who make the statement that Deep Space Nine is a betrayal of Roddenberry's vision of a utopian society, because Deep Space Nine is a little bit darker,
no,
or a little bit...
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
I would not agree with that at all.
That's good.
A true sign of a utopia is one where you are allowed to question what's going on. One where you are allowed to question authority, and question the ethics behind the authorities in operation.
Have you seen far enough to see Section 31?
I think I have, yeah.
Because I really like Section 31 and the whole, like, dynamic between Bashir and Section 31, where you have Sloan being like, you know, whatever, defend the Federation by all means necessary, mm-hmm. and then Bashir being like, but what about our principles, guys? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really cool.
As an interesting idea, but one thing that I thought was, one of the themes that I thought was brought out pretty well in Deep Space Nine was the theme of personal belief opposing Federation belief, and how you had to how the characters had to personally, personally,
grapple with the situation?
Grapple with and compromise with them.
That's fair.
What I thought was kind of that's what I picked up.
Yeah, and I think that's true, because I think the Next Generation,
mm-hmm.
and I guess this is also true in Voyager and Enterprise, but they hardly count. But in The Next Generation, you have, in most episodes, the characters are able to solve the situation with all of their personal principles and beliefs intact. Whereas in Deep Space Nine, you have a number of instances where the characters are forced to compromise their beliefs in order to solve a problem.
I think that's part of why people didn't like the idea that it was different from what Gene Roddenberry had, because it was different. And I think a lot of people initially kind of were attracted to Star Trek because of that sort of episodic feel to it, that whole things happen, we do things about it, things are okay at the end.
Well, a lot of TV was structured that way in the 60s anyway.
Fair enough, yeah.
60s, and, I mean, well, like, shows with continuous stories have become more popular since the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
But Deep Space Nine was not the first, but one of the first to have that kind of continuous story, and obviously Babylon 5 was running alongside it and had a similar thing going on. And then later on we had, you know, BSG and, mm-hmm. I wouldn't say Stargate. I was about to say Stargate. By the way, have you seen any Stargate Universe?
I get a bad taste in my mouth every time you say that.
Because I just wanted to comment that Stargate Universe is totally Voyager reimagined.
That's what I've pretty much heard.
Which I actually think is kind of cool. It's funny, because Stargate Universe does Voyager better than Voyager did.
It doesn't mean it's a good show.
I think it's a decent show. Yeah. I'm definitely not going to give it any awards.
I know pretty much the bare minimum about Stargate.
No, that's fair.
I know there are pyramids and aliens.
There are an enormous number of pyramids.
And that's
there's some guy
show,
that looked
right?
like Kurt Russell with a military brigade that went through a gate somewhere.
There's some guy, then they made a TV series out of a movie, because everything in Stargate works different in reverse.
And yep. The movie had that guy from The Crying Game in it.
Did it?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. All right, so if you guys, anyone paying attention, will remember that the week before last, we were talking about time travel. We didn't quite finish up on that because...
Good lord, we didn't.
There is a lot of time travel.
My goodness.
Then we took last week off because of Ren Fair, which was really fun, by the way. Bob and I had a lot of fun at Ren Fair.
You just wore your Starfleet communicator.
I did. It was so much fun because I was dressed as a pirate. And then I had this really awesome Starfleet communicator that my girlfriend Lillian found for me at Goodwill, which was apparently a really rare find. Like, I looked on eBay and these communicators sell for like $50. And this one was just hanging out at Goodwill for $5.
That's your plug for Goodwill right there.
Yeah, definitely. So I had...
They'll owe us money next time.
So I had, like, I was just walking around with this, you know, Starfleet communicator kind of hidden in my pirate outfit. And anytime anyone would see it and comment on it, I would just be like, you're not supposed to see that. The program must be malfunctioning. and then at one point, someone, poked it and was like, it's not working. And I'm like, well, yeah, it doesn't work for holograms.
Snip, snap.
and everyone had a good old laugh. So that was a
living
lot.
Living the geek dream.
So that was a lot of fun.
Have you ever been to a Renaissance Fair?
Absolutely.
Fun, ain't it?
Yeah.
I wanted to go in full Star Trek costume, but I didn't have the money to drop on a Star Trek costume.
We can do it next year. How about that?
Maybe next year when I've had time to, I have time to sew one. And by sew, I mean yell at my friends who can sew until I can get that to happen.
That's how I pick up trade skills.
And by yell, you mean, you know, timidly ask and beg.
And bribe. Don't forget bribe. All right,
so, never forget the bribing.
So back to time travel. We'd kind of finished up with DS9's time travel, and now we've moved on to Voyager time travel, which is a whole other level of silly. Although, I actually, one episode, and I'm sad that I don't remember the name of this episode, but I think the first Voyager time travel episode is the one where they find, like, the little micro wormhole that goes back to the Alpha Quadrant. And we don't find out it's time travel until the very end of the episode, because it's too small for the ship to go through, but they're able to send messages through it. And they're sending...
Is that the one where they beam Romulans aboard?
Do that? Yeah, that's the one where they're sending a message to a Romulan ship.
Yeah, in like 2250 or 2350 or so.
Yeah, and then they find out at the very end of the episode that the ship is like 70 years behind them in time.
Something like that.
And it's a cool episode, because it's like, it shows the Romulans in a, like, as decent, you know, sentient beings, and not just... You know, the Romulans aren't trying to exploit or go against Voyager in any way. Like, they're kind of suspicious at first, but when they actually understand Voyager's situation, they actually agree to help. And I thought that was cool. I really like portraying, the traditionally hostile races in a slightly more reasonable light, just because I feel like sometimes they get a little bit one-dimensional. So that was technically a time travel episode, and I did very much enjoy it. But the one that everyone... really remembers, and then of course there was Time and Again, which was also technically time travel, and that was the one where, like, they go to the planet that's been destroyed by, like, Polaric energy, and then Janeway and Paris get, like, teleported back in time to right before the explosion.
It throws down the Prime Directive Order hammer.
Right, that's the one where Janeway is like, no, Tom, you won't warn these people, because you don't know what the consequences of averting genocide would be. And it's just like, okay, that's the line we're going with, Janeway?
Yeah, really.
What is it with Starfleet and genocide?
Well, it's especially, like it's kind of weird, because, like, they first introduced the Prime Directive in, like, TOS as, like, this thing that was there to protect less advanced cultures, but Kirk very clearly indicated that you were allowed to ignore the Prime Directive if doing so was the only way to save some, like, you know, a race from extinction or from some kind of mass calamity. But then in Next Generation, they took a little farther with Pen Pals, where they were like, nope, we have to leave these people to die, Prime Directive.
Yep.
But at least you'll notice that in that episode and in all the TNG episodes with the Prime Directive telling them to leave people to die, they ignore it.
And then there was that Enterprise one of the Prime Directive being referenced.
Are we talking Dear Doctor? Yeah.
Yeah, that one was just really confusing.
That was just really bad. But Voyager and Enterprise took it further and actually have the characters allowing extinctions and genocides to go on because of the Prime Directive. So that's, and you know, the Prime Directive is a whole other kettle of fish. So the one that everyone really... Kettle of fish.
We've had this discussion, believe me.
Okay, so look, you get me a kettle of fish and we'll talk.
Get your own damn kettle of fish.
All right, so, but the first Voyager time travel episode that everyone really remembers is Future's End. And I think that's the right episode. That's the one where they go back in time to California. And that has certainly had nothing to do with the fact that Voyager is filmed in Los Angeles.
Nope, not at all.
They could have gone anywhere. They just chose California because it was, you know, it was cool, I guess.
Such a freakosaurus.
Did they actually say that in that episode?
Did.
Oh, my goodness.
Because it was a two-parter, right?
Oh, yes. God.
They said it in both, I believe.
Oh, dear.
And Sarah Silverman was in this two-parter as well.
Yes, she was. She drove a VW Bug. Have you seen this episode, Grace?
Van.
I have not.
Oh, right, it was a van, not a bug.
Or bus. What do you call it?
It's a van or bus? It's a VW bus.
Okay. The hippie car.
Yeah, which was, and that episode was just like, it was really, really over the top.
It sounds like a less entertaining version of The Voyage Home so far.
It, kind of.
Hey, Voyage Home is rad.
That's why I said less entertaining.
Well, there's a lot of things less entertaining than number four. I mean, that's a big category there. That's a whole tub of stuff in there.
I mean, that's kind of what it was. And they also, that was the episode where they introduced the time travel police, which I always had a problem with, because it's like, why specifically did they show up now of all times? Like, there's been time travel all over the Star Trek series, but now there are time police.
Are they, like, really lazy time lords or something?
No, they're from, like, the...
Oh, man, they should be, though.
I wish. I mean, there was that one... we talked about this 2 weeks ago. There was that one Star Trek Doctor Who crossover.
Yeah,
that one. No, these guys were humans from the 29th century who came back, and one of them was like, hey, you Voyager, you cause a time bad thing to happen, so I'm gonna blow you up so that doesn't happen no more.
Doing bad things.
Which, of course, in a true predestination paradox sort of issue, him trying to blow them up to stop the bad time thing causes the bad time thing to happen.
Yep.
Which really, you would have think as a time travel, he would have seen coming.
Nope.
But it just sort of raises the question of where the time police were all these other times people were busy breaking the timeline.
Yep.
Like, why didn't one of them show up when McCoy, like, you know, teleported back in time and ended the Federation by saving a woman's life? Why didn't they do that? Why didn't they show up then?
Really, I think there's a lot of different... The only thing I can come up with to justify all this is that there's many different types of time travel.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way I can justify it. So, the forms of which, like, you know, McCoy did, or... what was the one DS9 when we were talking about last
Little Green Men?
Weeks ago? Not Little Green Men. It was where the Defiant was in Earth orbit, and the Chronotons were polarized.
Oh, right, the Bell Riots.
Yeah.
That one. So those types of time travel actually erase time police. It's like the Achilles heel of time police.
I guess that is one kind of...
I don't know, like, let's call it time travel A, I guess, if you want to. And then there's, like, time travel B, which actually creates alternate reality, and time police actually try to fix alternate reality.
You lost me.
So, like, time police want to fix the latest Star Trek movie, for instance. Let's go with that.
I certainly hope they can.
Well, there's a sequel.
There is a sequel coming, which I hope has the time police.
So they can fix time travel
B, but they can't fix time travel A, because in time travel A, they've been erased.
This sounds like a serious job problem for time police.
But they don't know any better, the time police, because as far as they're concerned, all time problems are time travel B.
Mm-hmm. And in defense of Future's End, even though it was really silly, it was more entertaining than most Voyager episodes heading up to that point. If for no other reason than because, like, more of the crew than normal got to do something, because it was a two-parter, if for no other reason, and so you had, like, the majority of the crew was off the ship and doing stuff.
The only part I really liked was the crazy dudes out in the desert when the shuttle went down or so.
Yeah, that part happened.
That was really the only part I enjoyed of the entire two-parter.
That episode, although the part about it that really bothered me was that Voyager couldn't outwit, like, a 20th century ex-hippie-turned-businessman, and they just couldn't deal with him. And he was, like, he was using a bunch of technology there was no way he could possibly understand correctly, and he was...
Well, he was flailing about, like, you know, a kid that found his dad's gun, is the way he was using it. And it was just working, you know, he was accidentally firing off the shots, and they were hitting stuff.
Yeah, I guess.
You said that, and I couldn't help but imagine today on a very special Star Trek.
Oh, dear. Star Trek with an after-school message.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that was...
I could totally see Patrick Stewart giving a PSA.
Hello, children.
Yeah.
I'm fairly certain he has, although I'm hard-pressed to provide proof.
I am YouTubing that shit once we're done.
Yeah. And then we had, like, there were a couple of others after that, but I'm going to go ahead and skip ahead to the big one, which was the Year of Hell. Which, again, no time travel police this time. Because that was the one with the crayon, but that's not actually what they were called.
We can call them crayon anyway.
Yeah, the crayon.
This has just been the cast of, you know, mispronunciations today, hasn't it?
It is.
So Crayola comes along with their time shift, right?
Basically, this group of this interstellar empire, like, got beaten down, and they had this one time ship that was trying to correct the problem and, like, you know, and reestablish their big empire. And, like, Voyager showed up with some quantum shields that Seven invented and messed up one of their time experiments. And this was the one where, like, Voyager gets beat all to hell, and it was supposed to be an entire season, apparently. Apparently, Brandon Braga wanted to make the Year of Hell an entire season, like, that was supposed to be season 6, but he was told no, and so he made it a two-parter instead. And then at the end, they had, like, a literal reset button.
Yep.
But I think, of all the ways that Voyager has done time travel, I actually think the Year of Hell is probably the best they've done it, because it was actually, like, the time travel was actually... Like, it was fully integrated into the story. It was, like, a big part of what was going on. And
instead of being a gimmick, it was actually, you know, the focal point of the story.
Yeah, and it was self-consistent. Like, they established that, you know, they established very early in the two-parter that if there's some kind of object messing up time, if you destroy it, time will snap back like some kind of temporal rubber band.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the whole thing, was that the time ship was trying to blow up Voyager, and Voyager was trying to blow up the time ship. And it created a nice dynamic, and it worked pretty well, I thought. Plus, there's that one scene where Voyager goes to warp, even though their hull is all compromised, and pieces of it are just flying off.
Yes.
And that was a really cool special effect.
Yeah, that's going to end up on someone's windshield, though.
Was this also the episode where Tom Paris had invented these bulkheads that Titanic used?
Yeah.
Is this the same episode?
Yeah. That episode was funny because...
I heard that line. I was like...
Well, it's funny because you hear Paris saying, like, yeah, the Titanic totally used this compartmentalization. And I'm like, all ships today use that kind of compartmentalization. That's just standard.
But Janeway points out that the Titanic sank.
Yeah, the Titanic, like, really? Not the best example.
This is a horrible comparison, Paris. I expect better from you.
Are you going to use Hindenburg technology next?
God, he might.
Look, I have a feeling...
He's going to make a hole out of Betamax.
Look, knowing
Janeway's...
He's just
going to go with horrible technology.
Look, knowing Janeway's attitude towards her crew, I'm willing to bet that she specifically told Paris ahead of time to use that analogy so that she could then make everyone feel bad with her counterpoint. But, you know, because that seems like a kind of rant.
What?
Personally, I was just weirded out that Voyager didn't already have compartmentalization. That just seems like something that a spaceship would already have.
Well, they talk about bulkheads slamming down all the time when, like, shit becomes compromised.
Yeah, so I don't really know what those modifications were supposed to be.
Paris thought it was cool, though, when he sold it to Janeway.
Paris did think it was cool. And then they had, like, a, you know, a regular full-on... They also, I also liked how they, like, dropped torpedoes at the back of their ship when the launchers weren't working. You know, although that episode was even funnier, because in that episode they actually did understand the concept of a fuse, which is, you know, the whole reason why they're stuck in the Delta Quadrant was because for some reason they couldn't put their torpedoes on a timer. But then in this episode they could. And so
the rules are definite, except when
too much
not.
Forethought. Janeway's first command.
First command.
And don't you forget it.
And then there were, like, a bunch of episodes that had, like, the time travel police in them. Like, the one where they go back to Voyager as it's being constructed. And this one, again, it was
they're
like...
They're chasing Braxton is what they're doing, right?
Yeah, but
they don't know it's Braxton at first.
No, they find out it's Braxton later.
Tony Braxton?
Yeah, no.
We wish.
Not Tony Braxton.
I would have watched that.
And then, of course, there was... And that episode is, again, it's like, well, the time travel police are investigating this for some reason, but not all the... They didn't care about the Year of Hell. Maybe they only care about human time travel. Because none of that... The Year of Hell time travel wasn't caused by humans. So maybe they have a temporal prime directive where they're not allowed to stop other people's time travel shenanigans.
Maybe human-based time travel police.
Or... I mean, that sounds really dumb, but at the same time, the regular prime directive is presented as being really dumb, too. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe.
I mean, I don't even want to think about that.
You notice that they don't show up to stop First Contact, either. it's like, hey guys, the Borg have just time traveled to...
Well, that's an example of time travel A.
Yeah, it is. Okay.
Remember, they can only fix time travel B. They can't fix time travel A.
Alright. And then, of course, Voyager is ended with time travel in Endgame when Janeway comes back with Batmobile armor.
Yes, the Batmobile armor.
Which, I was a little confused, because in that episode, it sort of indicated that, like, Voyager... Like, the plot of that episode is that Voyager finds the transport conduits, goes back home, doesn't go back home, destroys the Borg instead, and then a bunch of their crew members die before they're able to get home, and so Admiral Janeway, that sounds sick.
She gets all Ripley'd up.
Yeah.
Does the whole alien shtick.
She basically comes back and is like, you know, hey, regular Janeway, you made the wrong choice, you have to get your crew home and, you know, never mind destroying the Borg. Maybe someone else's job. But
really? That was actually expositioned in that episode where she had actually gone on instead of going through the network to destroy the Borg and then went home?
Yeah, that was actually, like Admiral Janeway, old-time Janeway, we'll call her, because she's old.
Okay.
So old Janeway, her timeline was that she destroyed the Borg rather than use the transwarp conduit. And as a result, Seven of Nine died, and, like, Tuvok... like, had some kind of degenerative condition that they weren't able to get back to the Alpha Quadrant in time to fix. And Chakotay committed suicide. Or no, he didn't commit suicide, but he, like, you know, died of a broken heart or what have you, like, as soon as
That's
they got home. Yeah, well, you know, Voyager was taking lessons from episode 3 before it even came out.
LOL.
But then basically, so old-time Janeway... funny story, in Endgame, in the future town, Tom Paris is a holonovelist.
Yep.
but...
It's true.
Which is, you know, just fits right in with Paris being able to do anything. But, so old-time Janeway goes back in time and tells regular Janeway that she made the wrong choice. Or actually, first she tries to lie to regular Janeway and say, hey, we can totally destroy the Borg and go through the transwarp corridor.
So wait, are you telling me we get to see Janeway belittle Janeway?
Yeah, but that actually happens all the time in Voyager. That's actually a theme. There are at least three different occasions where Janeway argues with herself.
Man, yep. She just hates on everyone, doesn't she?
She does.
Janeway's a hater.
And she's gonna hate. But that's...
Oh man, that's why there's no ship's counselor. Because it would be such a foil, they couldn't get the character right.
Oh boy. But, so anyway, then old-timey Janeway reveals that she's actually just there to get Voyager to use the conduit instead of destroying the Borg.
Right? I'm sorry, we're still giggling in the background over right. non-Counselor Voyager.
But the original point that I was making, the original point is that it seems like in the beginning of the episode, like, regular Voyager would not have found the transwarp corridor without old-timey Janeway's help. Like, she shows up and is like, hey guys, there's a transwarp corridor over there. As I recall, like, that, maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's
no, because Harry Kim made a big fuss about it.
Oh, did he?
Before they had left, because they had rolled up on it. There's like, there's this big transwarp signature thing. Ooh, let's go check it out. And they go over there, and Harry Kim's like, oh man, let's go home. And Janeway's like, no, bro, no, not happening, Borg, not happening, bro. And Harry Kim then goes pouts somewhere, and then Janeway comes back, old-timey Janeway comes back, and was like, no, Harry Kim was got it right all the time, girl. You gotta go back there and get in that conduit, girl.
I got the weirdest mental image when you say old-timey Janeway.
Old-timey Janeway.
Give me that old-time Janeway.
No, thank you.
I'm right. Good. But as silly, and then so that episode is really silly, and they like, basically they give the Borg... Like, they kill the Borg the same way you always kill the Borg, by giving them some kind of horrible virus.
Yep.
Which, you know, you figure the Borg would have...
The Jeff Goldblum route?
Yeah, basically. And you figure the Borg would have taken steps against that by now, considering how many people have used it on them. but then they also, like, gave the Borg, like, they were actually pretty clear that the Borg weren't all destroyed. Like, they were crippled. Like, they're... You know, like, for some reason, their big space station exploding crippled the collective, which sort of defeats the point of having a shared hive mind if there's still a central point you can destroy. But anyway, beside the point, yeah, Voyager ruined the Borg for a number of reasons. But aside that point, they sort of established that there are still Borg remnants, even though their majority of them have been destroyed. But now all those Borg have future Janeway technology. Like, they absorbed all the Batmobile armor and all the phasic torpedoes that can transport through shields, which is weird. I don't know why the torpedo doesn't just go through the shield. Like, transporting through the shield is just weird, because transporters can't go through shields either. I don't know how that works. But anyway, they have those all now. So when the Borg start to rebuild, they're going to have all this extra technology, and it's gonna be awful for everyone.
It's going to be like having 5 printers and 1 computer.
Oh goodness!
Why would you do that?
Exactly.
Okay. And then right after Voyager, we get into Enterprise, which has somehow managed to top Voyager for having the worst time travel, because of the temporal Cold War. Woo!
He's waving his hands around.
I am. It's pretty rad.
There's one thing I really like that your girlfriend's mom said the other day about Enterprise.
Oh please tell.
It's that she had to watch a worse sci-fi show to then sit down and bear Enterprise.
Yeah, she watched all of Lex.
Yep.
And then she watched Enterprise, and suddenly it didn't seem so bad.
Yep. That's exactly what happened. And like, and now knowing that, I think I could actually finish Enterprise now.
You're not missing that much. I mean, season 4 is okay. But, like, the temporal Cold War just raises all kinds of questions. Like, you know, like, again, this is the same as the Time Police. Where was the temporal Cold War in every other series? Why are they only showing up now?
Well, they had Daniels, who was, you know, actively being Time Agent.
Right, right. But, like, you know, it's pretty clear. Like, if you look at the temporal Cold War, like, these people are not very good at covering their tracks. Like, they leave pretty recognizable footprints on the Enterprise universe, with, like, especially with the Sphere Builders and all that nonsense. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of strange that, like, you know, we never saw them until now, and it's just the sort of thing that you can't really just shove that into a setting and say, hey, look, guys, these people were here all the time. And, you know, it's just, like, it seems weird that the temporal Cold War people are so preoccupied with this one era of time. And of course, it's time travel, so nothing they do makes any sense. Like,
maybe they're just weird historical enthusiasts.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, like Civil War enactors.
Oh man, the time travel bad guys are the SCA.
Yes. Oh goodness. Yes. Oh no. And you know, okay. I guess next time we go to a Ren fair, we're going there to spy on them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Make sure they're not up to any good.
Okay. So, but
how
this
could
is,
they be up to good?
They're not exactly. We just established they're the time travel bad guys.
But this is my favorite. My favorite example of Enterprise time travel being really silly is in Stormfront, which is the episode that some people remember as time traveling Nazi vampires from space.
Yes.
Because they go back in time.
Them again.
Yeah, I know, right? They're cropping up all over the place. So basically, at the end of season 3, they get exploded back in time to World War II, because it's always World War II.
Of course.
And they find out that a bunch of space vampires are helping the Nazis, because always the Nazis, right?
Always the Nazis.
And they're from the future. And that the plot of this episode is that the leader of the space Nazis is part of the temporal Cold War, and that he escaped to the past. And that the whole thing is that they want to make sure he doesn't come back to the future. But this entire storyline is really silly because, like, he goes back to the past, like, he escapes into the past because, like, they were about to arrest him in the future.
Uh-huh.
But now he wants to go back to the future where he was about to get arrested, and, like, he hasn't done anything. Like, he hasn't, like, built a huge army or anything. He's just trying to go back to the future, and it's like, why would you want to... Yeah, I know, back to the future. And it's like, why would you want to stop him from going back to the future? You can arrest him in the future. And he's not, like, he doesn't bother, like, changing history or anything. Like, you really, what you think he would do is
well,
now...
Well, he did change history, like, hella, though.
Well, he did, but that wasn't his... He wasn't changing history to wipe out his enemies. He was changing history so... He was helping the Nazis so that he could get the things he needed to build a time machine.
Right.
And you'll notice that the Enterprise is not told you have to stop him from changing history. They are told you have to stop him from traveling forward in time. And it's like, why do you care about that? Like, all that will happen if he comes back in time is he'll return to the point... If he goes forward in time, excuse me, he'll return to the point where he was about to get arrested.
Hey, what Crewman Daniels wants, Crewman Daniels gets.
Yeah, Crewman Daniels is dumb. And that episode is also great because they drop a torpedo on New York to blow up a building. And it's like, torpedoes are like... 40 megaton nukes.
No, but, it's cool, bro. Don't worry about it.
No, it's cool. It's like, you're going to blow up a building with a torpedo.
Yep.
Okay, I guess. I could buy that with the phasers, you can turn those down to be low enough intensity to blow up a single building without hurting the rest of the city, but I don't buy that you can do that with a torpedo. Torpedoes are, you know, they got torpedoes in them. They're pre-packaged deals. You don't get to turn down a torpedo. There's no setting on the torpedo that reduces the amount of torpedo inside it.
You can't set a torpedo to stun.
Set torpedoes to subtle.
Then I'm pretty sure there was a TOS episode where they established they can set the ship's main phasers to stun.
Yep. Shit to stun?
You know, I wasn't meaning to say that.
Well, you said it. Now we're making a big deal out of it.
Okay, that's fair.
You're welcome.
And so then, of course. Alright, so then of course we get...
Fist pound just happened between myself and Grace. happened.
There was a fist pound. If you guys hear a weird, like, bump in the sound, it's because there was a fist pound going on.
That's right.
There's also going to be a slight of all the awesome in the room.
Some kind of... It's like
an Is that what awesome sounds like?
It's an electrical charge.
I can't say I've heard it in a very long time, so...
What? A Bob, I'm hurt. I am hurt. Anyway, moving on. So after...
Wow, look at that tangent we just went on.
So after Enterprise, with its absurd little temporal Cold War stuff, which, incidentally, is pretty much the exact way you shouldn't do time travel, because it's there, but it isn't really doing anything that you
I'm
going
to call this Time Travel C.
Time Travel C?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Because it's like, it's there, but nothing that happens in the temporal Cold War actually needed time travel to do it. You could have just... very easily had a group of advanced aliens manipulating, you know, all the people. They didn't have to be doing it from the future. That was just a needless thing that the writers did as a gimmick.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, it doesn't make any sense. It damages the continuity. And it's needless. And so then, of course, we have the movies, which have different approaches to time travel. And the one that everyone thinks of is, of course, and the first one with time travel is The Voyage Home.
Woo-hoo.
Now, Grace, have you seen The Voyage Home?
Yes.
Okay, so, space whales.
Whales in space.
No, it's just whales taking a ride in space. They aren't actually space whales.
Until the end.
Look, there was a log. I imagine there were whales in that log.
Oh, but...
I don't know. I mean, that movie is, like... Just for the record, I like that movie. I like Star Trek IV. It's a good movie, but its plot is asinine, which is a fun word I like saying. But it's like, because, you know, first of all, it's like, all right, so how did, first of all, like, if let's just assume for a minute, like, that these aliens from across the galaxy are hearing the whales, that means that either A, the whales have to have some means of transmitting their whale song through space, or B, the aliens have, like, super sensitive listening equipment that can actually hear sound from all the way across the galaxy. One of these two has to be true.
Yeah, that or a really long boom mic.
Yeah, I could see that. But if it's, like, if it's A, if the whales are somehow transmitting their song, then that implies they have a very advanced tech level. So,
maybe there's, like, a psychic ability to whales that we don't know about.
I'm not sure I can handle psychic whales yet, Grace.
Psychic whales!
But really, you think the idea that's already there is more plausible?
I mean, what I'm... But, alright, so even if we assume psychic whales, that's incredibly powerful psychic... So the point is that the whales would have to have a very powerful transmitter of some kind to do this, and if they're capable of something like that, why are they letting themselves get hunted to extinction? I mean, I don't remember the last...
No one said they were smart.
I'm on nobody's side, because nobody's on my side.
I mean, like...
That's how I think the whale would talk. Just FYI. Like,
thank you.
Well, apparently there were actually supposed to be subtitles to that last bit of whale song at the end.
Seriously?
Yeah, there were subtitles, and they were really silly. And
do we know what they were supposed to say?
No, but...
They're saying, me am fish, me want to
eat. Do not harm this world, probe.
But apparently, if you go to the SF Debris website and look at his review, he puts in his own subtitles, and they're way funnier.
Oh, man.
Funnier than we are? Well, I find that hard to believe.
Sci-Fi Debris is a pretty funny guy.
Don't put us on a pedestal too tall here.
And then, of course, if it's the other way around, that the probe aliens have the technology to hear whales all the way from their corner of the galaxy, why did it take them so long to show up and do something about it?
Because all problems are responded to at Warp 2, so season 1 of TNG taught us.
They're taking a lesson from TNG. They were just like, all right, guys, there's a problem. Let's meander over there.
Let's meander over there. It wasn't moving very fast. I mean, when you looked at it in the movie.
No, it was just kind of coasting along.
Yeah, because the Saratoga wasn't in Earth orbit or anything like that, right? And it just kind of sat there while this probe just came along.
They're rushing forward on cruise control.
And then, of course, that episode also did one of the faux pas of time travel, which is that they just did it. Like, there was no...
Yeah.
There were no special circumstances. It was just, all right, slingshot around the sun. Time warp. And as has been brought up by other commenters...
Time warp, bad special effects. Go.
Hey, those effects were rad.
Come on, guys, let's do the time warp again. and it was like, and as has been brought up by other commenters, why doesn't Starfleet use that more often? I mean, like, you know, maybe to avert one of their crushing defeats in the Dominion War.
Because time police and time travel
don't,
B.
Don't say, no, this is clearly time travel A. This is
time travel B, Orange.
Anyway, the time police didn't show up to stop Kirk from getting some space, possibly psychic space.
That's because it benefited humankind to do that.
Are you saying it wouldn't benefit humankind to like stop Beta Zed from being occupied?
I don't know what the grand design of the universe is here, Orin. I don't know what the time police have in store for us. Okay,
look, the point is that there have been
plan for us. Show up now.
I mean, in actuality, time police that's 500 years in their past, right?
Well, the point is that like the Federation has this time travel technology which they can apparently just do. And obviously that's not the case, like, that's not the intention in the other Star Trek shows, but that is a precedent that this one sets. And it's like, you know, for example, why didn't they use this when, in Star Trek 1, when Viger was about to blow up the Earth, and they basically had to rely on Kirk's ability to bluff his way past the giant space probe?
Time police... said it was cool.
No.
Well, they haven't shown up. I don't know how else you want time police to interact with this computer, so I don't think we've revealed anything important.
If time police aren't there fixing the problem, and how do you know? Maybe they were fixing the problem already. You don't know.
Wait, what? I don't understand.
Exactly. That's how time police go.
What? Okay.
I can't put it in simpler terms. Time police have already fixed the problems that we think are problems.
All right, I guess I'll let that stand. But the point is that
It's time travel B, Orin. Time travel B happened, and they fixed the problem already.
All right, well, the point is that as we established last 2 weeks ago, part of bad time travel is that it shouldn't be easily repeatable, because it raises the question of why they don't do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've just demonstrated, that's a hard question to answer. And you know, Bob has been working really hard to fix it, and I do applaud his efforts on that. But
well, hey, as you recall, when we started 2 weeks ago in our time travel segment, mm-hmm. I hate time travel anyway. I fucking hate it so much.
That's fair.
Makes me so angry. Because there's only one episode I thought that did it well, which was yesterday's Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which you immediately saw what the ramifications were of, oh my gosh, Enterprise C no longer in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the only way I saw it done right, really, in my opinion.
All right. But Voyage Home, despite its really dumb time travel, is a fairly good episode in other... Excuse me, movie. Did I say episode? It's a fairly good movie,
it's an episode in
other respects, because they really run with their premise of, like, the crew being in, you know, in San Francisco, I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
The crew just hanging out in San Francisco, and everyone remembers the nuclear whistles.
Nuclear whistles.
And it's, you know, it's a characterization piece is what it is.
It was a fun one, too.
Which is, incidentally, pretty much exactly what the most recent movie ended up being. Was a movie with a really dumb time travel plot and really good characterization.
Mm-hmm. Once again, though, I think Voyage Home was also a really good way for them to sort of showcase some of the lesser-seen comedic talents of the crew.
Yeah, I'm really...
The original cast.
Yeah, I'm really sad that Sulu was supposed to have his own scene, but he apparently didn't get one because, of some issues with the child actor he was supposed to have the scene with. I don't know if that scene would have been any good, but as a result, Sulu and Uhura were the only characters who didn't ever get their own moment.
Which is a bummer.
And apparently, I don't think there were ever even any plans for Uhura to get her own moment, which I guess shows you how much the Trek producers value Uhura. That makes me sad.
Jerks.
But this is the only movie where Sulu gets to seduce a man for his helicopter, so...
That's true.
I am a fan of that. You're looking at me like you're confused, Bob.
Warren has a theory.
I understand that George Takei is gay. I didn't realize Sulu was gay, since he's got a daughter and a wife in the actual Trek universe.
Okay, all right. Now. Okay, so you remember that scene where Sulu is talking to the sweet talking to the dude about the helicopter?
I remember the conversation happening.
You remember the next scene how he just has the helicopter?
Yeah.
How did he get the helicopter?
Unimportant. I assumed you just stole it.
You can't steal a helicopter.
Sure you can.
No, you can't.
Why not?
Because it's a helicopter. It flies around. Like, it's not like a car.
Are you going to get shot down?
Yes.
Over San Francisco? No, you're not. Not in San Francisco.
If you steal a helicopter, I guarantee you that the moment the people realize you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, you know, even before 9/11, they will let the Air Force know that there's a rogue vehicle flying around over the city, and the Air Force will dispatch a fighter jet to escort you back to a landing zone.
Besides, you think he can't be gay and have a wife and kid?
He could be.
I'm sure he could be bisexual or something.
No, I'm pretty sure they've got
fine.
Beards in
there
the
was,
future.
There was this heavy insinuation that, no, Sulu is totally gay, coming from what I was hearing there.
Look,
so you think he seduced the pilot to let him get the helicopter?
I think that that's actually the most likely explanation for how he got it.
It would explain why he wasn't around in Mudd's women.
It may not even be that he... And I'm not even I'm being a little over the top here. I'm not actually suggesting that he slept with the guy for his helicopter. But I clearly think
I don't know, that's what I feel like you'd have to do for me if I owned a helicopter.
I think that he convinced the guy to give him the helicopter somehow. And I'm not sure how he did it, but
I think he convinced him by stealing the helicopter.
No, you can't
steal... Because I'd be
pretty
convinced that you have my helicopter now when you've stolen it from me.
But you can't steal a helicopter. It's not like stealing a car where you can blend into the other cars. There are no other helicopters flying around.
You don't know San Francisco. You weren't hanging around 1986. There are helicopters everywhere.
I guarantee you can't steal a helicopter. unless you have some really elaborate way of fooling the control tower into thinking that you are the right person for this helicopter.
Well, simple. He just used his whole George Takei voice and smooth-talked the control tower.
Oh,
hello.
My. I could see
totally
that.
I'm totally supposed to be here.
I could see that happening.
He just flew really low. I mean, radar has like a 500-foot...
I've heard rumors that there was supposed to be a scene where Takei actually does steal the helicopter and, like, punches the guy out or something. I don't know if that scene was ever...
See, you can't report stolen helicopter if you're knocked out.
I've heard this was a thing. I don't know if it's true. But you'll notice that helicopter wasn't sitting out in the middle of a field. Like, it was in a crowded, like, you know, airstrip. There wasn't, like, you know, it wasn't like there was no one around who would have seen him. Like, I just don't feel it's plausible that he stole the helicopter. I just don't think that works.
Well, there is a big difference. I mean, he was flying the helicopter in the first place, right? There's a big difference between a helicopter and a starship.
Yeah, well, that's right? true. But he did drop some lines that he flew something similar as a training vehicle.
Technology-wise, it's probably just, you know, easygoing once you've had the experience with a starship. You know, like comparing a motorcycle to a tricycle.
Yeah.
Technology-wise.
I mean, although apparently flying a helicopter, I've heard, the analogies that I've heard is that if flying a plane is like riding a bike, then flying a helicopter is like riding a unicycle. Because it's like, you have to like balance the helicopters, because like if you, like, because you know, helicopters move around.
Pedals and sticks and...
Well, because helicopters move around primarily by tilting the rotors. And so like, you have to be sure not to tilt them too far, or the helicopter will just flip over and crash.
Yup.
We need to find someone who actually knows how to drive a helicopter and ask about this.
Internet, I come to you.
As a point of reference, Grace, no one can drive a helicopter. despite what World of Darkness would tell you. What, every vehicle in World of Darkness falls under the drive skill. What do you want from me? I'm going to go ahead and drive.
I want you to drive a helicopter, Warren. That's what I want.
Drive a helicopter. All right. So, anyway, after the voyage home, the next time travel movie is Generations, which is bad for a lot of reasons. The boast of which being that even though it does, to its credit, the time travel in Generations is non-repeatable. It's like due to the ribbon. It's still really silly because Picard like uses it to like go back to the worst point possible. Like, you know, the only point that he could have gone back to that would have been worse than the point he did go back to, which incidentally is right before he loses, is if he'd gone back to right after he lost. That is the only way he could have done that worse.
Oh, damn, am I late?
And like, instead of going back to the Enterprise Bridge, like, you know, a day before this happened and getting to save the Enterprise, no, not gonna do it.
I miss the Enterprise D.
I do miss the Enterprise D. I was really sad when the Enterprise D exploded.
Why they actually replaced it?
Why?
It's because it didn't look good on the aspect ratio of a movie screen.
Really?
That is why we have the E today. Actually, the F today now.
Sir, no, we're not talking about the Enterprise F.
We have the Enterprise F.
No, it's not real.
It's CBS said it is.
It hasn't been on television. It's
CBS,
not real.
The CBS will feed you whatever canon they want.
All right, incidentally, what we're talking about is that apparently that CBS did, like, was it an actual contest or did someone just...
It was an actual contest that Cryptic was doing with CBS's approval called Design the Next Enterprise for Star Trek Online. So it was, because the official story is that the Enterprise E is lost somewhere with Captain Data. So somewhere away, just gone.
Okay.
It was investigating some starbase somewhere, and just never heard from it again.
Okay.
So they decided to build and commission the F.
Okay. I mean, that's...
Which is bigger and longer than the E.
I saw the F. It looks really silly.
It does look really silly. I agree with you. I didn't say it was a good or pretty-looking
ship. Anyway, the point is that I refuse to accept that it's canon until it's actually in a movie or a show. I mean, they can say it's canon, but at this point, because, like, it's so nebulous that, like, you know, it's like... You know, technically speaking, tech manuals are canon until they're contradicted by a show, but because they can be so easily contradicted, they don't really count.
Well, the tech manual isn't endorsed by CBS or whoever the IP holder would be at the time, though.
Alright. I'm pretty sure some of the...
Whereas CBS is saying, oh yeah, F, ooh, thumbs up.
This is making me worried that, like, the next Star Trek show is going to happen in the Star Trek Online universe.
Oh man, that would be rad. I'd love that.
No, it would not be rad. I love that. The Star Trek Online universe is silly.
You haven't even played it all
I've
that
watched
much.
You play it.
You've watched me play it, yes.
It's really silly. It's, like, full of all this really dumb stuff because it's an MMO, so it has to be full of all this dumb stuff.
Yeah, because you're coming at it as if it's an MMO. That's the thing. Because you're being presented with MMO.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you translate it all into actual, like, TV or movie and whatnot, I'm sure it turned out fine.
I don't think you're allowed to have an opinion like this until you've actually given it a
All
chance.
I'm saying is that
he
the
did,
Star Trek...
He did play
I did
for
play
roughly, I think, about an hour.
I played it long enough to realize that the ground combat...
You didn't even finish the tutorial!
Yeah, because the ground combat is
It was like, how do I fire the phaser? Arr!
Like, I was flying my plane... I was flying my ship around and having a grand old time, and then I had to go on the ground, and I was like, this is the worst thing I've ever done. And then I left.
Which kills me, because he was starting to play after the ground update.
Really?
Yes, and he said it sucked more.
Well, no, I didn't play it before the
or
ground
you
update.
You said it sucked.
I said it was really bad.
Right, you say it after, you did after the ground update.
Yes.
Is what it was. I'm sorry. You played it after the ground update.
So I have no idea how bad it was before the ground update.
Well, it played much more like an RPG, where it was literally, you're locked on your target and you're hitting your ability keys, what it was.
Look,
now, there's still that, but now you have shooter mode, and you're like, how do I activate shooter mode? And I showed you how, and you just weren't even into it.
Well, like, all I know is that in space, the game ran perfectly smooth. When I was on the ground, everything was chunky and blocky, and I couldn't, like, aim my phaser because of how, like, you know, how laggy everything was. Because
your computer isn't the greatest either.
That's not true. My computer is not, my computer's system requirements are not an issue here. Like, my computer has more than enough system requirements to run Star Trek Online.
But I have to run it on lower stuff to do it.
Yeah, but it's fine. I mean,
this laptop does a better job.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
But it does.
Are we really talking about this?
We are really talking about this, because this is our airtime, damn it.
Look, the point is that, all right, so even assuming that my computer is, like, you know, a Stone Age piece of crap.
I didn't say
that. The point is that the ground combat runs worse than the space combat, and I have to go on the ground to complete these quests. So that's what I didn't like. That's the reason I quit. But anyway, getting back to the original point,
what was the point?
The point is that the next Star Trek series should not be set in the Star Trek Online universe, because all that's happening in the Star Trek Online universe is that everyone is fighting everyone else, and it's like this incredibly ridiculous war fest, and it's like
war fest.
If it was a war fest, I'd be okay with it. No, it's a war fest, and
I'd love a war fest though.
And like, all anyone does in that game is shoot at each other, because it's an MMO. It has to be that way. And if you made the Star Trek, if you tried to make a TV series based in that universe, it would fall apart. Anyway, that's my opinion, and we've grown like way off topic. And I do apologize for talking about my computer. That had no place here.
Don't apologize. Don't apologize. They want to listen to this. This is fun for them.
Apologize.
Anyway,
So my our adoring fans keep telling me on TeamSpeak anyway.
Yeah, anyway. So we have one more time travel thing to talk about, and that's First Contact. Because, you know,
go to the past to simulate the future.
That's what they came here to do,
stop First Contact.
Have you seen First Contact, Grace?
No.
Okay. So the basic plot, for anyone who hasn't seen it, is that the Borg attack again. They get blown up, and then they... After getting blown up, they launch an escape pod, which goes back in time and attacks Earth right about the time that Earth was having first contact with the Vulcans.
Sounds like a party.
And, of course, this immediately raises the question of why they didn't just, you know, go back in time way out in deep space, where there were no Federation, where there was no Enterprise E to follow them back in time. So that's a question that no one has an answer to. And then, of course, although there is that cool moment where you get to see Earth all assimilated. I did like that.
Creepy.
Yeah, that part was pretty cool.
Oceans of red. Oceans of blood.
And it's like, the best parts of First Contact are the parts where they're on the ship fighting the Borg. Like, I feel like they did a decent job with the parts where they're on the ground talking to Cochrane and, like, building the rocket. But that did feel kind of like a distraction from what was actually going on in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the guy who played Cochrane did a pretty good job.
James Cromwell is a rad actor.
Yeah, yep. James Cromwell.
Isn't it Sir James Cromwell? That might be, right?
I mean, it might be. I don't know. They'll knight anyone these days.
He's a rad actor, but I don't follow him that closely.
But, like, anyway, the point being that, like, the time travel aspect is clearly a distraction from what's going on. And apparently, according to the DVD commentary, that was forced on them by Rick Berman.
Really?
Yeah, like... Apparently, like, I think it's Ron Moore and Brendan Braguer were the ones who wrote First Contact,
mm-hmm.
and they were going to have, like, a big epic Borg fight, and then Rick Berman told them it had to be a time travel movie, because Star Trek IV did so well. Because Star Trek IV is the highest grossing Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
And he was like, it has to be a time travel movie, because Star Trek IV did well, and he, apparently ignoring the fact that Generations was also a time travel movie, it did really badly.
Your logic has no place for Rick Berman.
It doesn't. Rick Berman hates everything Star Trek related.
Well, Star Trek Generations was probably still making its romp through theaters at that point before it was taken out when they greenlighted First Contact. Because First Contact only came out, like, not even 2 years later.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. But anyway, it was clearly forced on them by the studios, and you could see that as a consequence of the fact that the time travel storyline and the storyline of fighting the Borg on the ship barely interact. Like, basically at the beginning of the movie, almost, the crew that goes down to the planet is cut off from the crew up on the ship, and the only point of contact where they actually interact at all is Lily, the woman from the present who is beamed up and hanging out with Picard, is like the only point of interaction between the two storylines.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, she's cool. I like her. And I like her and Picard's dynamic.
She is actually Jonathan Frakes' godmother.
Oh, whoa, really?
Yep.
Oh, that's cool.
Wow.
that actually surprises me. I didn't think she was that old. She looks much younger than that.
I know, right?
But anyway, I especially like that there wasn't a romance between them. Because, like, at first I expected there was gonna be, because it was like, oh, look, a man and a woman on screen together in a movie. There's gotta be some romance going on here. And then there wasn't, and I was like, that's cool. They can have a relationship other than a romance. She can, like, call him on his, like, revenge obsession with the Borg, and he can yell and break his ships.
Not the ships.
He, you know, that wall of gold wall of ships. Yeah, he breaks him with a phaser rifle, because he gets mad.
Right into the glass case.
Fish are okay.
He doesn't have fish in the Enterprise E, does he? Do we ever see his ready room? Does he have fish?
I didn't see any Nemesis. I don't remember seeing any Insurrection.
I don't remember him having any fish. He probably...
Well, he had fish in TNG.
Yeah, but I don't think he had any fish in First Contact.
I don't know. Have to...
Granted, did we ever actually see the captain's ready room in First Contact? I'm pretty sure it was all the conference room. I don't think we saw the ready room
at all.
There
was his bunk or something like that in the beginning scene.
Yeah.
In the dream sequence.
Yeah, those were his quarters.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Because the captain's quarters are usually more lavish than that. Like, well, and that one's just like a bunk, and then there's this desk.
Well, that's because part of the Enterprise E was that they realized that spending, like, you know, 50% of the ship's available space on luxury crew quarters was a bad idea.
It took them a while, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
So comfy, though.
The Enterprise E, like, you know, was one of its good things, was that it reversed the flying hotel model of Star Trek, of Starship design.
Mm-hmm.
So First Contact, its time travel is really silly, but, and it's a good movie in spite of that, but it doesn't gain anything from its time travel, and it would have been a much better movie without it.
Mm-hmm.
If they just had it be a full Borg adventure, because then, like, you wouldn't, because, like, the parts that everyone remembers are the Borg fighting parts, and you have all the other characters who, no one really remembers what they were doing in that movie.
Or at least I wanted the roles to be reversed for Picard and Riker.
Yeah.
Initially, it was supposed to be that way in the first place.
Right, but Picard is a better agent. or something, I don't know, but maybe Patrick Stewart does really want Picard to be an action hero.
Patrick Stewart said that?
Yeah, like Patrick Stewart, there have been a number of times when Patrick Stewart has requested, according to commentary, I've never actually heard Patrick Stewart say this, but according to DVD commentary by, like, the writers, there were a number of instances where Patrick Stewart, requested that his character be more action-oriented.
Huh, interesting.
And apparently, again, according to DVD commentary, Captain's Holiday was a direct response to that.
Oh, God.
Yeah, the one where they go to Risa, and that was all, that was totally action-oriented.
Well, he does like fast cars, so.
Yeah. So, you know, that's probably why. And I agree, I think it would have been better if Picard had been down on the planet and Riker was up on the ship. But that's, you know, that's not what we ended up getting. And then, of course, we have the newest movie, which is the final, as of yet, example of Star Trek time travel. And, of course, it is completely bullshit. You know, I try not to swear on these podcasts because I think that makes me cool, but I just couldn't resist at that point because there's no other way to describe the time travel in the new movie.
I don't think you're going to get any ire from anybody except maybe iTunes, and that's it.
Which, again, I do like the new movie. Like, I will go on record and saying it was a good movie, but the time travel in it is really dumb.
Well, I don't want to play the devil's advocate or anything here, but J.J.
Yes, you do. Just do it.
Well, yeah, but I'm trying to be polite about it. J.J. Abrams, you don't have to be polite, pretty much went on record as saying that it is his version of Star Trek, is his interpretation, and that it is not strictly follow the standard Star Trek guidelines.
No, see, I don't have a problem with that.
If you take it that way with a grain of salt, then...
No, I am perfectly okay with the fact that it's different than regular Star Trek. I did not have a problem with the fact that it was basically a complete reimagining of Star Trek. Like, I was okay with all of that. What I didn't like about it was the fact that they had this time travel thing where sometimes going through a black hole time travels you, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you just die.
Yep.
And, like, again, they had this time travel, but the only reason they had this time travel was this really forced way of getting old Leonard Nimoy into the story. And I really don't feel like the story benefited from it at all.
Every movie benefits from Leonard Nimoy.
You know, I really like Leonard Nimoy, and normally I would agree with you, but, like, he barely does anything in that movie. And, like, he He has really...
I am Spock.
If you listen, bullshit. Listen to his explanation. He has really bad dialogue. Like, it's like they were like, oh, it's Leonard Nimoy. Whatever he says will be gold. And they just didn't care.
Were they expecting him to freestyle or improvise?
I don't know, but, like, the explanation... The majority of his dialogue is him giving exposition about the time travel plot, which is only there so that he can be in the movie. So it's this amazing loop of silliness. And he's the way he's trying to explain it, but it doesn't make any sense, and he explains it really awkwardly.
He also wears a lot of fur. Aren't Vulcans vegetarians?
He is anyway. Uh-huh. And there's that great.
They, Paul says that Vulcans are vegetarian.
Yeah, but I don't trust anything that Paul says about Vulcans.
Well, that is actually an extremely fair point, sir.
But
Orin 1, Enterprise 0.
But there's my favorite Spock line in that movie, and my favorite, I mean, the one I hate the most. Is when he says, is when he says the unthinkable happened. The supernova destroyed Romulus. And it's like, wait a minute, Spock, you just said that the supernova was about to destroy Romulus. How is that unthinkable?
What you
mean is the thing that I thought was going to happen happened.
Maybe it was unthinkably bad.
Here's the thing, right? You're on a freeway, and the car next to you is going 50.
Yeah.
And you want to merge into that lane, right?
So the supernova
is going 50, and you want to merge into the supernova's lane.
Uh-huh.
Suddenly, as you're merging, the supernova hits the gas pedal. It's going 55 now, and now it's T-boned you on the freeway. That's what happened to Romulus, is that the supernova stepped on the gas pedal.
I guess.
That's the only justification I can think of for that bit of dialogue there.
Spock was late.
Yeah.
Spock just didn't show up in time.
The supernova just stepped on the gas. This is just like, woo!
And then, of course, there's that scene, that really painful scene where they beat you over the head with the fact that this is an alternate timeline now, so things are different. And it's like, I knew that already. I didn't need a scene where they, like, belabored the point at me like that. I knew it. I accepted it. I was there. And I mean, like, you know, do you think that the people watching this movie are really dumb?
It was made for, like, a layman's audience.
Right, but, like, laymen aren't stupid. Like,
you.
American audiences aren't dumb. Like, you
then
know,
why can't, then how come the people who make the movies seem to think otherwise so often?
I don't know. Maybe they're aliens. I'm just saying.
It's
I
a conspiracy.
I'm just, most of my best friends are Americans, and they're most of them aren't dumb. I mean, some of them are dumb.
Well, the NSA will sleep better tonight knowing that, Orin.
But most of them aren't, and I think most people watching the movie already got that this was an alternate timeline. But then they have this scene where Spock is just like, do you understand that it's an alternate timeline? It is? Do you? Okay, we're moving on now.
Well, that's because I'm sure that there was, in the back of the minds of Alex Kurtzman's and Robert, is it Orky or Orsi?
Who are we talking about?
The writers.
Oh, those guys.
Their names are Robert Orsi, O-R-C-I.
I just think of them as the Transformers
and Alex Kurtzman.
Is that their names? Okay.
Yeah.
I can only think of them as the guys who wrote Transformers.
The only thing I can think of is that they had this niggling feeling in the back of their minds going, oh man, these Star Trek purists are going to come burn our houses down if we don't have a good explanation for this. And that's the one they gave.
Yeah,
I want to burn their houses down anyway.
Are you really saying that the people who wrote Transformers were afraid that they weren't dumbing things down enough?
No, see, first of all, thank you. But second of all, I can see that being a thing that they might have thought of. But if that's the case, they don't understand that no matter what they do, people are going to be mad at them for doing the alternate reality thing. And I find that silly. I mean, I think it's fine that the movie is an alternate reality. I'm actually happier with it being an alternate reality. That means I don't have to try to figure out what's canon and what isn't.
Leaves room for kickier costumes.
I just know that now that exactly. I mean, I just know that there's the Abramsverse. It's like how in Batman.
Where do we get to sexy costumes?
That's
or kinkier costumes. Where
I said kickier.
Oh, kickier. I heard kinkier.
Look, either one works.
It's like what left field are we hanging out in?
Mind,
like,
my goodness. Gutter.
It's
not my fault that the N word and the letter N got in there. All right.
So the point is that, you know, it's like how it's like
home
how
run
there's
after home run over here
for Batman. You have the Nolan verse, which are the Nolan movies.
Right.
Those are considered separate from your standard Batman continuity, and it means that Nolan can do whatever he wants and make his movies in a way that makes sense rather than being constrained by all the mountains of Batman canon that already exist. And that's good, and it's the same thing with the Abramsverse. So I don't understand why anyone would be upset about that, but obviously people are. You know, the internet is mad.
You can't please everyone.
The internet is mad about everything.
Angry.
So anyway, so that movie is good despite the fact that it's time travel. You know, I think this has set us a record for the number of tangents we've gone that have had nothing to do with our original point. So I hope that next time we will be more on topic.
Bah, where's the fun in that?
But we've...
What do you know? I do add something.
Thanks, Grace. Right. But we have officially run out of time travel. So what are we talking about next week,
we
Bob?
We have run out of time travel.
We have. There's no more time travel to talk
we
about.
We have run out of time travel.
We could talk about Doctor Who for a while.
No, I think we're about done for today.
We
for
have
this
run
week.
Out of time.
Bob,
travel.
Bob, snap out of it.
I'm trying to envelop this. Make
so
love
do we have any thoughts
thing.
We want to finish off with?
Well, usually we like to finish off with what we're going to talk about next week. Bob, you have any thoughts?
Do I have any thoughts on what we're going to talk about next week? I kind of want to talk about the Prime Directive next week.
Oh, that's going to be fun. All right, guys, next week we are talking about the Prime Directive.
All sorts of Prime Directive all up in. All
right, so Grace, thank you so much for being here with
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and I hope everyone else has a lovely night.
Stay classy.